Today's Taisho is on case 33 in the Mumon Kan, the gate of no barrier, or the station of no barrier. Case 33 is entitled Basso's No Mind, No Buddha. A monk asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "No mind, no Buddha." Mumon's comment, "If you understand this, you have finished studying Zen." Mumon's verse, "Present a sword if you meet a swordsman. Don't offer a poem unless you meet a poet. When talking, tell one third of it. Don't divulge the whole at once." So I want to thank everybody for getting up early this morning and coming into the Zendo and sitting together in the heart mind. Thank you so much for doing that. And some of you arrived last night, and it's really wonderful to see you. Some of you have been here before, and some of you are first-timers. So it's a very good thing to see all of you here. And we, participants, have been here either from last Sunday or last Tuesday, practicing the Great Way. And it's very wonderful to see new people in particular, and also people who have been away for a while returning to their practice. Thank you so much for coming. This is a very interesting koan, very important in the light of a lot of things, including today's events. A monk asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso said, "No mind, no Buddha." Now, you know, it doesn't really, no Buddha is not exactly the answer we expect, and no mind might not be the answer we expect either, especially because in a different koan, this is the exchange. Daibai asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "This very mind is the Buddha." So, in the earlier koan, somebody said to Basso, "What is Buddha?" And he said, "This very mind, or your very mind, is the Buddha." So a monk, it doesn't say if it's the same monk or a different monk, says, "What is the Buddha?" And this time Basso says, "No mind, no Buddha." So that's the koan. It's sort of a double koan, and this Taisho is a 2-for-1. So, I want to talk about, you know, we think about what we're doing as practicing meditation, as practicing sort of like mental, it's a mental cultivation. When you say the word meditation, people assume you're talking about the mind. And modern people think about the mind as something that is very closely associated with the brain, right? So when we think about mind, we think of mind and brain. And actually, there's been all of this research on mind that involves like taking various kinds of magnetic resonance images of the brain. So they put people into these tubes. Experimental subjects lie on their back, and they're put into these tubes, and then they're told, watch your breath, and they look at what the brain does. They do a brain scan, or read a comic book, and they look at the brain scan, and then they say, "See, notice how meditation changes the way the brain works." So there's a huge industry in the study of mind and brain and meditation. There's a scientist at University of Wisconsin named Davidson who's done all. He puts all these Tibetan monks into these tubes, and you know, has them meditate. I don't know how they meditate, you know, lying down in the tubes, but they do. And I don't know if they take their beads in with them, and you know, so on. But somehow they're able to get their brain scans, and you know, their brains perform differently from you know, non-meditators in significant ways. You know, one of my best friends in the world, and a member of long-standing member of our Zen community in Seattle, is a guy named John Sunstein, S-U-N-D-S-T-E-N. And John and another guy named Prebram were pioneering researchers on the study of the brain and meditation. So, you know, John was eventually a very serious Zen student, but in his earlier life, he was kind of like a hippie brain scientist. So, you know, he actually used to wear, he used to have long hair. He was a hippie scientist, you know, so he had long hair, and he would wear like paisley shirts that were open at the collar and bell bottoms, and he'd go into his lab and wire up the monks, you know, usually Japanese monks, and they did all these studies on the meditating brain, and indeed, you know, they would ask a roshi, they'd say, who is your best student? Who is your next best student? Who is your next most advanced student? And so on down the row, and the roshi would go, you know, it's him, 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 and then they'd measure their brain. They weren't putting people into tubes; they were wiring up their heads with little electrodes, but they noticed that the roshi was correct in his estimation of where everybody was, and that the very advanced meditators were performing at a different level than the beginning meditators. And so, you know, this was a big deal when it happened. In fact, Time magazine had a picture of a even though the research was done on Japanese monks, as usual, the Tibetans upstaged Zen, you know, because there on the cover was a Tibetan monk with his head wired up, right? You know, so they get all the good press, you know. So, but you know, it was a big deal, and I believe I don't know if John was cited in the Time article, but he definitely was involved in that. I believe Prebram was the guy who got a lot of the kudos for that research. So, you know, it's been about 30 or 40 years where people have been looking at the brain and looking at them and saying, you know, we can see now how the mind changes when we look at the brain. You know, and so we think of, you know, the mind and the brain is pretty much the same. And when I even try to explain meditation to people, I say, you're really just rewiring your brain, you know. So you know, if you do this, you're strengthening the neural connections, and if you don't do that, they get weak. There's a whole theory of the brain that if you do something repetitively, it strengthens neural connections. And then if you stop doing it, those degenerate. They break down very quickly. So if any of you know anything about brain science, please just disregard everything I'm saying right now, because I'm not a scientist. But all of this is pretty fascinating, I have to admit. But on the other hand, you know, it kind of misleads us. It kind of misleads us, because it makes us think that there's like this baseline thing called the brain, and that basically how we experience the world is pretty much uniform, and it's pretty much given by the wiring. You know, so we often say it's hardwired. You know, somebody, you might say, yeah, it's hardwired. You know, we often say that certain things are just wired into our brains. You know, so. There actually have been scientists who have made the case that like differences between men and women are, quote, hardwired. You know, so men are just wired to go to baseball games, you know, and or football games, and women are just wired to make the snacks, you know, that kind of thing. So there's this whole idea that we're hardwired for certain things. This is how modern people think. And when I'm explaining meditation to people, I try to use the language of my time, you know. So I say, you're changing the way your brain is wired. And people look at me like, I got it, you know. And so they sit down, they're rewiring their brains. Got it, you know. But actually, this is a very false view of the mind. You know, it assumes that there's something like a baseline mind, and that there's a baseline reality, you know. If we just do certain things, we're enhancing brain health. In fact, you know, there's all these products that are sold. If you Google brain health, you get all these products that people make that are supposed to help your brain. You know, if you take these vitamins, they help your brain, and so on and so on. Mind and brain might not be the same thing. And this is really important, and much more important than maybe modern people understand. Because, when Zen people talk about the mind, they really aren't talking about the brain. Some of you, I was thinking about people who are coming to Sesshin for the first, just to change direction a little bit. Hold that thought about the brain and the mind for a minute. But, you know, I was thinking about people coming to Sesshin for the first time. You know, people who have come to the Sesshin for the first time have maybe come to the sits at the university or at one of our other locations. And they probably think, oh boy, this is going to be great. You know, I'm going to go to a retreat. I'm going to unwind. I'm going to mellow out. I'm going to center myself. You know, I imagine that when I get to this Sesshin, you know, people are going to be very loving and kind. You know, it's going to be a serene, quiet atmosphere. And so, you know, the morning you get up, you arrive at the Sesshin, the morning you get up, there's somebody shrieking in the bathroom, and then she tears all her clothes off and runs outside. And it's possible to react to that event in a number of different ways. You know, one way you could react to that event is, and I doubt anybody really feels this way, but there might be a little bit of a feeling like this. It's like, you know, I came here seeking serenity, and instead, you know, there's this terrible, terrible thing going on, right? And that might cross somebody's mind. You know, it would actually be a natural thought. You know, I came here seeking serenity, and instead somebody is having a mental breakdown, a nervous breakdown, and shrieking naked on the grass. It might color your experience of the Sesshin. You might say, oh, well, you know, after that, you know, I just couldn't get into that serene place, you know. Another way to react is to say, you know, basically, she's having a nervous breakdown, right? And that this person must be, quote unquote, mentally ill. And that's an interesting way to think about it, and it fits right in with a lot of our assumptions, you know. It fits in with our idea that, you know, the mind and the brain are pretty much the same, and that there's a baseline of consciousness, which is like mental health. It's mental health, healthy brain, all of that stuff. And then what happens is that people somehow become mentally ill. We say mentally ill. And then they're no longer sane, right? They've gone from sane to insane. You know, there are a lot of, there's a wonderful psychotherapist whose work I like really very much, and her name is Martha Stout. And she wrote a book called The Myth of Sanity. The Myth of Sanity. Because she says, actually, it's not so simple that there's sane and there's insane, right? You're either totally sane or you're insane, right? You're either mentally healthy or you're mentally ill. And her book is really a wonderful, wonderful book because she says, you know, if you think about mental health, it's actually a continuum. And there are, you know, it's she points out that many Americans, like a significant number of Americans, have a crisis, like a mental health crisis in their lives. And when they have this crisis, you know, it's so in other words, most, you know, I don't know if it's most, but many, many people will have a mental health crisis in their lives. They'll go into a crisis state. They might fall into deep depression. Some people have a psychotic episode, and it's, you know, it's something that happens to many, many people. So it's not an extraordinary, unusual, it's not a sign of any kind of personal defect. It's a possibility that can happen to any of us, because the mind is really not what we think it is. It's not the mind is not one thing. It's like, you could say, like an ecosystem, right? And so the mind is something we create in our life, and we're creating it all the time, and other people are helping to create it. You know, if you saw I was in the grocery store 3 weeks ago, and there was a little girl. She didn't tear her clothes off, but she was sitting on the floor of the grocery store. She was probably, let's say, 4 or 5, and she was shrieking. My wife and I were buying groceries, and this little girl was just screaming, and her mother was ignoring her, and she was sitting on the ground screaming, and she was melting down. She was crying. You know, so, you know, when we see a little child like that, she was in emotional distress, but, you know, we don't usually see adults like that. And you can say, well, what's that all about? And what I think is that, you know, we're always creating our mind. We're always creating ourself. And as soon as we're conscious, we start creating our mind. We start creating ourself. And it's something we're busily creating all the time. You know, and sometimes we create the self in a way that's a little bit rigid or a little bit closed up. And something happens to us, and, you know, it causes like a crisis. You know, we'll have a crisis. And our self sort of like becomes disorganized or begins to sort of like come apart a little bit. And you know, when that little girl was sitting on the floor of the grocery store, you know, that was happening. It's like she had a self, but, you know, something was challenging that self, and it was sort of coming apart. And it isn't always as dramatic as that, you know. Sometimes it's very dramatic, you know. But I think, and I'm not a mental health specialist, you know, and I might not know what I'm talking about, but I would say that we're constantly creating our mind. That there isn't like a baseline mind. That we're constantly creating our mind by imitating other people and trying out new experiences, and we gradually create a self, like an ecology. It's like planting the self is a little bit like having a garden. You know, you start out with nothing, then you plant seeds, and the seeds grow, and, you know, then you have weeds that you didn't expect, and you have to pull the weeds out, and at some point there's a crisis. You know, and some of your crops die, and you could, become very sad that your garden isn't working out, you know, and you could give up gardening, or you could, you know, to pull out the plants that have the vermiculum wilt and put in something else, you know, and so, you know, you become like an adaptive gardener if you're interested in being a gardener, you know, or you quit gardening. And I think it's a little bit like that, in that we create our mind, right? So you know, if you just accept the idea for a minute that there isn't like this baseline mind, there isn't this brain mind thing, that the mind is really very open ended. You know, if you were to be a world explorer in the 18th century, you could sail across the ocean and go to someplace in South America. And you would see people behaving in a way that you would describe as totally insane, right? And if people came here and visited from another planet, they would say, perhaps, especially America right now, they would say, insane, right? They would say, people are actually killing each other over small green slips of paper. You know, we can't explain it, right? Yes? And so what, you know, we think of ourselves as very rational beings, and we think of most people as being the mind as being something that's sort of given. It's here. The mind is something that everybody has. That it's pretty much the same. And I would say that's not true. You know, from the time we're born, we're creating our consciousness. And it's really an consciousness is like an ecosystem, and it's like an activity. And, you know, we're constantly making and remaking it in response to challenges to our self structure, you know. And things challenge us, you know. When you're a little kid, if you live at home before you go to school, generally speaking, your parents are, I hope this was the case, are loving and kind. So, you know, I had a very wonderful mother who was, you know, I look back on it now and I don't know how she did it. You know, she was so patient and kind and so generous. And so she created sort of a home life for my brother and sister and me that was really this very, very nice, interesting, friendly place. And then, you know, at that time, we were living in Baltimore, and I started going to school at the Yorkwood Elementary School in Baltimore. And, you know, when I first got to school, I couldn't believe it, because there was so much violence, you know. I was under threat of being beaten up almost every day. And that was like the climate of that place. It was like a tough school, and you know, I used to like plan my route to school to try to avoid like known bully locations, you know. So you know, it was a shock for me to leave the sheltering world of my family and go out into the public schools of Baltimore, and it challenged my identity. It challenged my self-structure, and it forced me to remake myself in lots of ways, and it's a struggle. You know, I definitely had moments where I felt defeated, you know, as a little kid, and I'm sure you had these too. You know, we don't really think about it this way, maybe, but the self is something we're creating all the time. And there's constant crises to like the coherence of our mind, right? And we have to respond to challenges by remaking ourselves and restructuring our awareness. And so, you know, eventually what I realized, I went out for different sports. I used to run track, and I tried to be athletic, but you know, I was never really an athlete, I have to confess. I was on the swimming team. But then I realized, you know, I could be good at school. And so, you know, I created this identity of the smart kid, you know. So, you know, I began to get, you know, I used to work really hard to get excellent grades, and I would win awards. Like, I would get an award for scholarship, you know, in high school. Every year I'd get the trophy. This trophy for scholarship goes to Kurt Spellmeyer, you know, and I'd go up and get my little trophy, and, you know. And then I got to college, you know, and in the 70s, when I got to college, you know, everybody was a hippie, and I came to college, and I was totally square, you know. I was like, I had black plastic glasses, and I wore plaid pants, really, and I wore polo shirts, right? So it was like, I was like living in the 1950s, you know, and I thought I was going to be a pre-med student, right, and so make my mother so happy, you know. So, you know, all of a sudden, my smart kid identity got me nowhere. And I was in, I shared rooms. They had all the S's in one dorm floor. We were all the S's, you know. So, you know, basically my roommate was Tom Singer. And Tom Singer should have been named Tom Swinger. Because Tom Singer was so handsome. He had long black hair. He was totally cool. And he was sleeping with girls all the time, right? And he would say to me, "Look, man, would you mind bunking with the other guys tonight?" You know, and he'd have a joint in his hand, right? You know, and I'd say, no, Tom, that's fine." You know, and we were all the squares. You know, we'd watch this beautiful woman come in, and she'd go into his dorm room. "Hey, baby," you know, it's like, "Oh my God," you know, "what does he have that I don't have?" You know, and at one point, he was rooming with one of his lady friends, and I was just cleaning up our room, and I noticed there was an open letter. This really happened. Everything I say in Dokusan is the truth, and there was an open letter, and I read it, and I guess he, you know, basically it was from one of his girlfriends, and she said something. There was literally like, this is like something out of a magazine or novel, but he said, "You know, I'm sorry your roommate isn't very cool," or something like that. Oh, ouch, not cool. And I looked, you know, I had my sandals and my, you know, polo shirt. So I started to become a hippie. I grew long hair, you know, I fought with my parents. "No, you know, I'm not cutting my hair," you know. And I grew a little beard, you know, it was not a good look, you know, but because I used to have, like, I have rather frizzy hair, and it's black frizzy hair, and, you know, and I looked like a black haystack, you know, so, but I felt like I was getting to be cool, right, you know, we go through these threats to our identity, right, and so there isn't like this self that's just this baseline self or this baseline mind, you know. There, you know, basically, there is no mind of that kind. You know, we create our mind through, you know, interactions with other people, through experiences we have, and how we consciously and unconsciously knit those experiences together. You know, and a lot of this processing goes on unconsciously, but we create a self, and then it has these challenges. And, you know, these are like everyday challenges. If you live in Baltimore, getting beaten up is an everyday challenge, or it used to be, you know. In the 60s and 70s, not being cool was a challenge, you know. So, and you know, then, you know, you're an A student in college, and then you get out and you have your first job, and the person treats you like dirt, and it's like, "Excuse me, sir, but I'm an A student," you know. And he just doesn't appreciate my, you know. So anyway, these are challenges of a sort of normal kind. But things can happen to us that, you know, really challenge the structure of the self. And if you've created, and it's nobody's fault, but, you know, if you've created a self that's a little too brittle or a little too inflexible or a little too... all self-designs have their problems, right? So, you know, things can happen to you that challenge the self in a way that just makes it seem like it's an insurmountable task to put it back together again. We've all had moments, I think, where we've actually been in those places, you know, where we've been in those dark places. And, you know, maybe we weren't tearing our clothes off and sitting out in the grass and shrieking at the top of our lungs. We might have felt like that. Or maybe it's just, I know that at one point in my life, I had a pretty significant depressive episode. And it was just like darkness descended on my mind. You know, it was just getting up in the morning was so hard, right? And it was because I had experienced these challenges that just... consciously or unconsciously, they just seemed impossible to surmount. You know, and I went to a therapist, and that person was, she was really wonderful because, you know, basically a skillful therapist makes you realize these are manageable problems. You know, yourself is in disorder right now, or it's in disarray right now, but let's be creative together about how we reassemble yourself, how we reassemble your mind. You know, and this is, you know, I really benefited from this process when I was younger because it helped me through my depressive episode, but it also made me realize, you know, I can be like a gardener of my own consciousness. You know, I can make my mental world a project. You know. And of course, Zen is a big aspect of that. You know, the idea that mind isn't automatic, it isn't given by our brain, it's something we actively create. It is could be frightening, right? It could be a frightening idea, but it's actually very liberating. You know, I mean, I think one of the good things that therapy does is it helps you realize, you know, you not only are you not going through this alone, but a therapist is giving you the tools you need to go through this on your own later. So you sort of remember your lessons, and you remember how you know yourself better. You know your self system better, and you know how to make repairs. You know, and usually, I mean, I must say, going through that depressive episode was really wonderful for me. It's one of the reasons I am interested. I got into Zen, but it's also made. I think it made me a much more resilient person. And you know, I was just reading. There's a professor in the anthropology department who's now retired, but I he's like this super brilliant guy, and he probably wouldn't even talk to me, if he knew who I was to begin with. But he's this brilliant cultural theorist, and he wrote a biography, and I was reading an excerpt of it in Rutgers magazine, and he talked about the fact that when he was a graduate student, he had, quote, a severe mental breakdown, right? I'm not really convinced there is such a thing as a mental breakdown, because again, that implies that there's something like this permanent fixed mind that's totally stable, and suddenly it just cracks and breaks open. And I think that almost makes things worse. I don't think the mind is like that. The mind is an ecosystem. It's in flux all the time. It's changing all the time. It's a dynamic system. This is Zen 101. The mind is a dynamic system. It does go through moments where it becomes appears to be disordered. And it does, you know, there are threats to its integrity, you know. But breakdown makes it sound like you were sane, and then something terrible happened to you, and you were totally crazy. And that is a false view. You know, the mind is an ecosystem, and it undergoes change, and it experiences crises caused by change. And you know, if you have a depressive episode, or you have a psychotic episode, people come out very often on the other side of those experiences more resilient. You know, at first, after my depressive episode, I certainly didn't feel resilient. But it definitely, when I had similar challenges later on, they didn't bother me as much, right? It's like, okay, fine, I've been here, you know, I've been here. And I think Zen is doing something very similar, right? You know, it's Zen is about creating your mind, right? Creating your mind, and taking responsibility for your mind, for what it is. So we tend to think of it as something that's given to us, right? It's just there. There's a mind, and you're sane. Most people are sane, and then there's these people who go insane, and that's like that's a very, in my opinion, false view. You know, if we think of the mind as a dynamic system, we all undergo crisis quite often in life. Some of the crises are very big, and some of them are relatively small. But crisis and partial like fragmentation of the self is part of being alive, right? And so what we should be cultivating is resilience and flexibility and openness. See, these are all things that I think koan training does. You know, basically, you know, working with a koan, you know, sometimes it's a crisis for the self, you know. I remember when I first started doing koan training with Genki Roshi, because I had, you know, distinguished myself in high school as a good student, you know, when I began to get failing marks on my koans, you know, it really depressed me. I didn't fall into deep clinical depression, but I began to feel this very bad feeling, like a hopelessness or something, you know. But then, you know, I realized, you know, maybe it doesn't matter if I answer my koan. I'm really enjoying the practice of Zen. I love sitting, and there's something about this that I can't fully describe, but I really want to keep doing it. And, you know, and then when I was no longer trying to get good grades on my koans, so to speak, you know, I began to have much more openness in the process. It's like, who cares if I answer the koan, you know? And I began to enjoy being stumped, you know, being lost, being confused and disoriented. And because at the other end of it, I had a bigger picture. I had a bigger life. You know, so I think Zen training is all about developing this kind of mental flexibility, this kind of mental openness and resilience. And at the core of all this is trust. You know, every morning we recite at Sesshin the verses on the heart mind. I think it's how it's translated as, but it's really trust in mind. Trust in mind. So, you know, the mind is an intelligent system, and it's much more complicated than we realize. Our consciousness is only like a thin film, you know, the core of this ecosystem, this dynamic ecosystem, is invisible to us. It's the unconscious mind, but it is extremely intelligent and generous and loving. If we just trust its wisdom, you know, we will get through any crisis, you know. So, you know, I think it's very important to understand that when we're doing Zen, we're not really just like, we're not working on our brains, right? That sort of takes the responsibility off our shoulders. We're creating ourselves and we're creating our consciousness. You know, there is no fundamental consciousness. You know, consciousness is an emergent property, right? It's like there's no there there. It's an emergent property produced by all these other factors. But once self-awareness arises as this so-called emergent property from all of these contributing causes, you know, then it creates itself. You know, it creates itself. It becomes a dynamic system. And so, you know, it's more enabling for people. It's more liberating for people to understand that there isn't such a thing as sanity and there isn't such a thing as insanity. Those are not helpful terms. The mind is this dynamic system and it experiences crisis. And when it experiences crisis, the worst thing you can think is, oh my God, I'm going insane, right? As though there is something called sanity or there is something called insanity. You know, I wouldn't really worry about sanity and insanity. You know, I would worry about, you know, basically being open to learning, being open to the possibilities of the moment. And, you know, creating a more open, flexible, and dynamic mind. And we all have moments where it doesn't work out, you know. There will be moments in life where we get knocked on our ass, you know. That's definitely the case. You know, I remember many years ago, I had written this article that was really, I thought, was the best thing I had ever done in my professional life. And it was published, and it was a little bit controversial. And then a year later, just before I was leaving for Sechin, I got this journal in my field, and the lead article was by this woman I know named Min Lu. She's from mainland China. And she was, I thought, my friend, right? And then I noticed that in the first page she's citing me. Of course, how wonderful, you know. And she tore me apart, right? It just, you know, I mean, a part of me said, oh, this doesn't bother me. You know, this is just professional life, you know. But I was so injured and hurt by that. And I went to Sechin and I couldn't quite put this down. You know, this injury was so, I felt betrayed by a friend. I felt publicly humiliated by her critique of my work. I felt unjustly attacked. You know, I could go on and on. But it took me a while to recover from that. You know, that was like, it wasn't a major crisis, but it definitely hurt a lot. Yesterday I was talking about the koan that has the line, everything is our rice. You know, there are many challenges to our self system, so-called. There are many challenges to the integrity or the dynamic healthiness of our mind. But everything that challenges us is an opportunity to create a more living ecosystem of consciousness, you know? So that was a good thing for me. To even though at the time it was painful and difficult, you know, actually, believe it or not, this person actually, years later, I was at a conference and she came up to me and said, you know, I kind of regret some of the things I said. You know, I had to be pulled off of her neck, you know, because I was strangling her. But, you know, it was fine. You know, it's okay. You made some, actually, she had some good points. I hate to say it, but she had, you know, in fact, now I would actually agree with her on most everything. Really, I'm there now. I wasn't then, you know. It just hurt. But she was right. I hate to say that, but it's true. And I learned a lot from reading her essay, too. Even though it hurt, you know, a lot. So these challenges to our mind as a system are the only opportunity to become bigger people, bigger, connected, healthier, adaptive, loving, and kind people. And, you know, koans are like little crises to your mind's coherence, right? Every time sometimes with koans too, you feel like am I losing my mind? You know, I have no idea what I am doing, you know. And it's like a little moment of insanity, so called. But actually those moments are really wonderful and productive. You know, I mean, it's the only way to get out of your rut, right? Out of your rut. And you know, when people do have these episodes, you know, it's sometimes because they have made actually very courageous life decisions. And they push a little farther than they become comfortable with, and then they're filled with sort of like terror. It's like, you know, they've gone out on a limb, and now they're out on the limb, and they freak out, right? You know, maybe out of, you know, their courage or their integrity put them out there, and then they look around and they aren't ready for the challenge. You know, so it's definitely the case that people of great integrity and courage can have a crisis like that. And as I said this morning, you know, people like that, they come out on the other end, and they're often incredibly well integrated and generous and kind people, like this super genius in anthropology. You know, he never would have done the breakthrough work he's done if he hadn't gone through that crisis. I'm quite sure it taught him how not to freak out, basically, when things are falling apart, when things seem chaotic and threatening and incoherent You know, there is a part of us that starts feeling like, oh my God, am I losing my mind, right? And yet, you know, when you realize if you do lose your mind, it's okay, because it's going to reassemble itself, and it's going to reassemble itself in this more coherent way. It's like the mind is this dynamic, like almost like living system, and it's going to reassemble itself. You have this core, this unconscious core, which is constantly working to help you. It's wiser than your conscious mind. And so, you know, in a way, when people freak out or when they are in a crisis and they hit the panic button, it's because they don't realize that they have this ally helping them all the time. Please trust your big mind. You know, please trust your big mind. But actually, even the big mind is a dynamic system. You know, as I say, there's no there there. Awareness is an emergent property of many cooperating causes. And once it becomes self-aware, it becomes a dynamic system. And then it's up to you what kind of world you want to live in. And you wouldn't be here if you didn't want to live in a Buddha world, which means a world of boundless compassion, curiosity, generosity, and so on. So thank you for pursuing that. A monk asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso said, "No mind, no Buddha." Mumon's comment, "If you understand this, you have finished studying Zen." That's a joke, right? Your mind is never going to be stable. It's never going to be finished. Basically, it's a dynamic system. It's always changing. Any new experience is going to be a big or little challenge, and you're always going to have to be creatively drawing this into your circle of your mandala, right? Into the mandala of your life that you create. And it's really a mandala of our lives that we create collectively. Okay. So Mumon is playing a joke on us. If you understand this, you have finished studying Zen. Mumon's verse, "Present a sword if you meet a swordsman. Don't offer a poem unless you meet a poet. When talking, tell one third of it. Don't divulge the whole at once." So, in a way, he's saying, trust your big mind.